Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Gary Simpson is speaking on the Good Samaritan and the Good Society. So let's listen in on Gary Simpson.
The other day, yesterday, 2 days ago, on Thursday, I did the fourth of my presentations, which I called Participatory Ethics in Public Spaces. And one of the things I've been trying to make the case in order to have a good society is that we have to work on what some people call mediating institutions, or these institutional places between these two great mega institutions of our society that we usually call the economy and politics for short. Between our more private and intimate spheres, like our friendships, our family, our kinships, there's a whole area in our life that isn't necessarily that maybe you can distinguish from economic structures and systems and political structures and systems and our intimate spheres, that I think in our country in the last, maybe even in this century, but at least in the last 50 years, and gradually kind of have withered a little bit on the vine, that I would call mediating institutions, or that I would call the civic sphere. And whether those are, I mean, there's all kinds of them, from neighborhood groups to churches and congregations to organizations like Tom works with, an ecumenical organization in Minnesota. Are you in both cities?
St. Paul.
St. Paul. To other kinds of church organizations, to labor unions, to environmental groups, to all kinds of small groups, to even things like study groups and book groups, and you might even include those kinds of things in here. Because in that area of life, that's a little different than your areas of kinship and intimacy. And it certainly is quite different from the large-scale economic and political organizations and systems. I think it's in that area of life. If I were to draw pictures, I would draw, looks a little bit like Mickey Mouse in some ways, you know. The economy and political structures, we'll just call them that for right now. And then our, what I call the life world, which are these more intimate and our friendships. What's happened, I think, in modernity in our time is that this area down here has kind of gotten squashed by these two mega systems. And so our life feels meaningless sometimes and fragmented and all kinds of things that we might talk about down here, how life kind of is jagged. And part of it is, I think, that this area in here has also become squashed and diminished. And it's what I would call mediating institutions or civic spheres. Yeah, can't spell it closer. Or what I called yesterday or Thursday, public spaces. And that this area, we haven't paid much attention to, or nearly enough attention. When Eastern Europe, when the Iron Curtain fell, the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, Eastern Europe tried to think about rebuilding their society. In the West, over here in the United States, the media focused on what they were doing to create market economies and to create democratic governments. But what they spent as much time on over there is building up this area of life and rejuvenating, think of Poland and the Solidarity Movement, which was primarily a movement down here, actually helped to bring about the fall of their kind of government. In their kind of government, these two circles were very close together. In our kind of government, they overlap more and more. So we probably have a mixed economy or a liberal constitutional state. They spend a lot of time thinking about these mediating institutions that mediate between these two mega institutions and our kinship and friendship kind of places. And I'm suggesting that congregations, one of the things I think has happened in the last 50 years since World War II in the United States, is that congregations have, while they originally were up here, have allowed themselves to fall down here into areas of intimacy and privacy. And we've thought that we've come to think of our congregations as kind of little intimate circles, almost like kinships and friendships. They become very, almost like kinship societies. They become kinships, you know, of course, are rather exclusionary groups, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Hard to marry into a family and really become part of it.
Very hard.
And so congregations often think of themselves, I think this is a dangerous way to think about yourself, which is a statement on my part, is for a congregation to think of themselves as a big family. Because families are really nice sometimes for those on the inside, but it's very hard for a stranger to come into a family. And so congregations often think of themselves internally. They think, wow, we're really, you know, we're really friendly and warm, and visitors come. And they feel outside. And the people on the inside say, well, we're really warm and friendly, and we're like a big happy family here. Well, that's exactly one of the problems. I'd like to start thinking of congregations as more public spaces that overlap and also in some ways become part of this larger public sphere, a civic sphere. There's something wrong with that word. And so my strategy that I've been pushing for in order to get towards a good society or a better society is to kind of pump this area up in the middle, so that it becomes an overlapping area, and it is primarily the area of moral deliberation, or moral argumentation, and that there's all kinds of institutions in here, and that create a lively public conversation and argument about things. And what I've been kind of pushing towards that model, and on Thursday then I began to spell out some principles, four principles for what kind of argument and how you would participate in this public sphere. And it was these four principles that I call the discourse principle. Oh yeah, so there may be a few of the left. And basically that's what I would call, I suppose you could also call it, the participatory principle. That only those norms or only those values, I'll call them norms, only those norms can claim to be valid or true that meet or could meet with the approval of all affected, of anybody affected in their capacity as participants in a practical discourse. And that's what goes on in the real arguments, practical arguments and discourses. So that that's really the participation, the participatory principle. Basically, I threw that into a little maxim for those of you who weren't here, that it's been an old principle, ethical, moral principle that says, decision makers should be consequence takers. If you make the decision to do something, you should take the consequences of it. I've been working on that with my children. It's what parents do often. Well, you made your bed, now you have to sleep in it or lie in it, those kinds of things. That's kind of a negative one. It's also a positive side, you know, you made some good decisions, you get to live with the good consequences, good either way. But decision makers ought to be consequence takers, and that's an old one. The flip side of that is the thing that is really the participatory principle now. Consequence takers should be decision makers, ought to be decision makers. So if you have to take the consequences for a moral decision, you ought to be involved in the making of that moral decision. Now that sounds like, in a certain sense, that's also a democratic ideal or principle, a participatory principle. The next one I talked about is the consent principle. And in some ways, it's it builds on the first one, and but it emphasizes talking about consent. How do you participate in a moral decision making? Well, you don't only do it by kind of giving your advice or collaborating, but you have to ought to be able to consent to it. So there are some kinds of management types, management structures or management styles that are, some people call it collaborative, where the manager gets all kinds of information, but the manager is the one who makes the decisions, despite what the other people can give input in, but they don't have to give their consent.
President Clinton.
Right. Well, I think actually Clinton is beginning to move to the consent, more of a consent style, which is why he gets him into a lot of trouble with a lot of people who don't think that you can never run a country that way. Maybe you can, I don't know. I had some interesting conversations the last 2 days with people in business, and they are people who are trying to advocate businesses moving more towards collaborative and also to consensual styles and consent styles. The consent principle says all those affected by the norm, general observation, can accept or consent to the consequences and side effects. That observation can be anticipated to have for the satisfaction of everyone's interests. So it basically tries to say not only collaboration and advice, but consent. The last two principles I've called the argumentation principle and the trust principle. And the argumentation principle says, well, why would anybody want to get involved in this kind of process anyway? What would motivate you to do that? And basically it says anybody that gives reasons for something in other words, even when I give a reason to my daughters not to do something or to do something, as soon as I give a reason, I am implicitly, I am at least pretending to accept one of my daughters as an equal. And as an equal partner with rights, and that I will not practice coercion with them. Otherwise, I would just say, do it. Don't ask questions. And sometimes I get to that point, you know. And there might be, because parent-child is still an unequal relationship. But one of the things you want to do, it's an unequal relationship that has the goal to bring equality or to bring an adult, mature person. So you graduate as they get older and older, try to give them more and more reasons. And as you do that, and as they are demanding, well, why should I do that? And as soon as they say why, then they're starting to realize, subconsciously or unconsciously or something, that they deserve reasons. And what they're doing is beginning to become adults and to demand reasoning. And actually, they begin to demand that of parents usually before the parents decide to give it. It's kind of the signal. And then as soon as parents start giving a reason, it's hard to back off from reason giving and trying to convince them. Because as soon as you're giving reasons, you're trying to convince. And you're trying to, sure. And you're trying to get their consent. This is really a strong statement, the argumentation principle in a certain sense. What it really believes, and what it's really trying to tap into, kind of reviewing a little bit, is that that inherent in all human language, rather controversial statement, in other words, cross-culturally, what functions cross-culturally in human language is across the differences of the language and the differences of the cultures around which all kinds of particular languages build up. That each language, no matter what the cultural expression, has an intention to say things that are true. And when you say something that is true, something that is true cannot be only true for you, for me. As soon as you claim something that is true, in other words, if you say ought, somebody, you ought to do that, you're saying, well, it's not only something for me that I ought to do, but as soon as you say to somebody else, you ought to do this, you're making a statement of truth that should be true for all people in those circumstances. That's a strong statement. Anytime you say something, that's odd. Really what this is trying to fight moral relativism and also kind of nihilism. So anybody, and it seems that all languages, and this is maybe an empirical question, you have to test it out, but all languages and cultures have oughts involved in them. And really what the flip side of oughts is why we need oughts in life is because the human creature of all God's creatures is in a certain sense the most vulnerable of all God's creatures. And I've used kind of the illustration around here. We can probably, you know, there's quite a vulnerability to the chipmunks around here. I mean, you could take one of those boards out there and squash them, and sometimes you'd like to. But interestingly enough, you know, when these chipmunks come up, are you new? When these chipmunks come up, you know, they're trying to steal your food on the plates or something like that. You can look this chipmunk in the eye, and there's one thing you cannot do to that chipmunk. You cannot destroy that chipmunk's self-esteem.
But they'd stare you right back.
Yeah, they'll just stare you down. They may be afraid of you because you're bigger. But you
cannot do that.
This is right. He's a realist with a lot of chutzpah.
Yeah.
You cannot destroy the self-esteem. There's you know, something about self-esteem, something about the human creature that I can look at my daughters and just, and very unintentionally, not even know I'm doing it, destroy their self-esteem by kind of raising their hair. You know, even a look. Well, that's part of why oughts. As soon as somebody is vulnerable and is being violated, then oughts begin to raise their heads, even cries. You scream out. So that one of the most universal of all oughts is do not murder, do not kill, do not do no harm. Sure, that's right. And so that involved in, there's another kind of, I think, another kind of very, very, very basic, fundamental, and I would claim to all cultures, and have to test that out, I suppose, that another kind of statement that seeks to be true are promises. That all cultures seem to make promises to one another, people who need maybe against them. So you have oral oaths and promises. The last one that I've been trying to push forward is the trust principle. And this is in some ways is the one I'm going to work into for today then. That in order to why engage in this kind of a process at all, in arguments, and how can, once you come to consent, once people consent, how can you trust that that's consent and not coercion, subtle coercion? Probably with my children, it's pretty tough because they may say, okay, I'll do it. I'll say I'm sorry. Right? You try to explain to them, you try to argue with them, you try to give reasons why they should say they're sorry. And, okay, I'll say sorry. No. Do you really trust that? No. And then you say no. Okay. So there has to be this trust also, finally. They might go and say they're sorry. And that's okay too. Sometimes, you know, I say, okay, well, I know you don't want to, but do it anyway. It's good practice. You find out it doesn't hurt so bad.
So you can make it.
Yeah.
But find out it doesn't hurt so bad. People forgive one another. Life goes on. All kinds of other things. So sometimes, you know, what did you say?
Fake it till you can make it.
Fake it till you can make it. That's it. Fake it. They'll find out that they'll make it.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. But deeper, on a deeper level, you want them to get to trust. And each of those affected can convince the others, the trust principle, reciprocal conviction, I say, in terms that the other person holds appropriate. So this is a strong, what's going on here is in the face of a very multicultural and pluralistic world with many, many cultures that are quite different from one another. This is the principle that says, in order for the other culture to trust you, or the person from the other culture, or a person from another situation to trust you, you must convince the other person, not only in your own language, but you must somehow work to convince them in language, in their own language, so to speak, within their own cultural perspective and situation.
That's what that first part. Each of those affected can convince the others in terms that the other person holds appropriate for the perception of both their own and the other's interests. Their own and the other's interests. That the constraints and impact of a norms, of an ought's general observation are acceptable for all. And each can be, and then also that I can be convinced, that each can be convinced by everyone else, by all, in terms that she or he, in terms that I consider appropriate, that the constraints and impacts of a moral ought's or a norm's general observations are acceptable for all. So it's kind of mutual convincing. What you really have to do, oh, there's these things like little statements like,
Walk a mile
in the other person's moccasins. These kind of intuitions. Now that's very difficult to walk a mile in somebody else's shoes. You get blisters. They're either too big or too small. They don't fit well.
Try a wheelchair. Mm-hmm.
Try a wheelchair.
Different. Or blindfold yourself.
Yeah, okay. Blindfold. All kinds of things like it. Very different. Social perspective taking. You're talking physically, but also I'm talking primarily culturally at this point. But
I'm just wondering, it seems like when you put in there for all, that makes it so, I mean, the likelihood of anybody being able to do that, and I think of the way mediation works, where you don't think at all about, is this acceptable for everybody? You think, is this acceptable between these two parties? That's all that's needed. And so it seems to me that this is such, I mean, it's a nice standard.
But it's so otherworldly.
So strong.
So strong, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
What's the value of it almost?
Right. It is so idealistic, so platonic, so otherworldly that it does, it's impossible to do. The catchphrase is the beginning few words, each of those affected. So even that is pretty strong. So each of those affected can convince the others. In other words, if you have to take the consequences of the decision. So that could bring it down to practical discourse about like how we would do this play, how old the village would run. Wouldn't be able to convince everybody that lives in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I would defend, if I was going into, I mean, you're exactly right, I would defend a weak version of this. In some sense, this is a universalizing principle. It does have everybody involved. Those affected is probably, but even that is pretty strong. Everybody, can hold a village would have to accept this principle. Mm-hmm. Well, you know what that means. That means that you have those kinds of moral conversations only about certain kinds of things. Otherwise, the place would grind to a halt. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, very quickly, it would grind to a halt. You couldn't make, it's a moral situation whether you cut up your orange peel or not.
Right.
And so what happens is a community learns certain things and puts them into norms. And then what you have to do is go back up to, there's some sub-principles under the discourse principle. Like everybody has, even a moral norm that's working in a particular place, like cutting up your orange peels one of the sub-principles under that I don't include under there was anybody in the community could raise the question, well, why should we have to do that? So it can actually raise a question over against. Now, a couple of things. This kind of process takes a lot of time. You couldn't do it on everything that happens. In fact, one of the questions comes in. One of the reasons that I'm suggesting that this kind of argumentation take place here and had a moral culture of these mediating institutions is because if every question of the economy, for instance, had to be answered this way, the whole economy would kind of grind to a halt. Or every question in the political organization. And so what happens is, over a period of time in the conversation of a country, for instance, certain slices out of this, we'll call it a pie for a second, certain slices out of there might be picked out. And it's usually kind of over a period of time, some kinds of conversation is going down here that intersects here and here. And there's a moral conversation that comes about in the political life. And other parts of this are kind of going on without this kind of ongoing questioning. and a piece is pulled out and brought down here, and maybe pulled out and brought down here by what goes on down here. And we debate it. Now there's a huge chunk going on right here, you know. There's a big piece going on in our society right here. There's more than one, I suppose, but there's at least a couple. You could call it healthcare. That has come about in all kinds of... Oregon has been a very interesting place. Any of you from Oregon? In Oregon, for the last 10 years, there's been something called Oregon Health Decisions. It's a grassroots movement. In fact, the president who was behind it originally, one of the persons behind it is the present governor of Oregon. Kitzhaber, isn't he the governor?
He's
up for governor. Is he governor?
No,
he's up for governor. He's running for governor.
Barbara
Walters. It's been a while since I've been there. Barbara Roberts actually played some roles before she was governor in Oregon Health Decisions. And Oregon, down here, in grassroots organization, grassroots meetings at all kinds of levels, all over the state of Oregon, was raising these kinds of questions in the state of Oregon. So Oregon has entered this debate and is far ahead of most other states. So is Minnesota.
So using that as an example.
An example.
Why wouldn't you, and applying this, why wouldn't you want to state it? Since one of the key things in here is everybody affected.
Yeah.
So why is it enough just to say that? I mean, if somebody in Oregon were using what you're talking about as a way to, okay, your students have been so moved by what you say that they now know how to go out and have a public discussion like this. So it just seems to me that if they spend all kinds of time thinking about how is this going to be true for everybody everywhere at all times, that would be such a debilitating discussion that nothing would ever happen. So why not just work with all those affected by? And that's bad enough. That's the state of Oregon. Now it's all of the United States. I mean, that's hard enough. So why not, this is my own bias. I'm interested finally in what works, what people can take and do something
sure.
with. So why not?
Why not just say all those affected rather than the universalizing principle?
Yeah.
Well, I guess the reason for me is because I think that there are some things that are universal. And one of the things that I'm trying to argue against is certain kinds of postmodernisms. Mm-hmm. Let's say there's nothing that all the cultures are incommensurable. They can't talk to one another. There's nothing that crosses cultural boundaries, no single thing. So while healthcare in the United States would be tough enough even to get it across the United States, and have, you're going to have a lot of unhappy people as it is because he's turned into a political situation. But so I'm trying to fight this kind of moral skepticism that says there is absolutely no such thing as moral truth. So actually, I do think that there are some. I think they're probably few, but I do think that they're quite strong. So I state this in order to do that, and then I back down. I state it. On most decisions, it would be weak. It would be weakened in our... But I do think there's a few. I think that I'd challenge anybody to go into any culture and say... that you ought not say. I mean, what you end up doing, I think, what I think some skeptics, postmodernist skeptics, when it comes to moral skeptics, and say there is no moral truth at all, I think they end up in a performative contradiction, because even that statement, there is no moral truth, is a lot.
Right.
And so what they either have to do is admit that they're in a performative contradiction, by the very statement itself contradicts their point, or they have to just withdraw from the argument. So if they answer the argument at all, if they are, they believe that there are some things.
Okay, I would think a truth, but I know it isn't true because I see what the world's doing is that everyone wants peace. Not everyone wants peace. Not everyone's against war. Not everyone wants behind me. No, but it's not everybody.
Right. Well, so maybe that's not universal.
Well, name me something that's universal.
Well, I think the Ten Commandments try to work on that. Thou shalt not kill. And you have to define what killing or murder is. Murder is different than war. There's a long tradition in the West that makes a distinction between murder and war, between self-defense and war, and between self-defense and murder. And generally speaking, in our country, we have several. Everybody agrees with that. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody agrees.
Euthanasia? No.
What's that?
There's euthanasia. There's people who are.
Oh, yeah. There's lots of things on the edge.
There's nothing that anyone always agrees with.
I think that everybody agrees that first-degree murder in this country is, except for, you know.
But what about these kids? What about these kids that go out with guns and shoot somebody because of some dumb argument?
Now, you would have to worry about, that would be like the consistent moral skeptic would not even enter the argument. And, you know, people who are, well, I suppose we would call them sociopaths.
At 12 years old is scary.
Sure it is.
Even younger.
And ask what violence has been done to them.
Right, that's one of the ways. I mean, I'll give you an example. I'll talk about my daughters because they're not here, and I like to do that anyway because it's things even, that I remember.
You even talk about them when they're there.
Yeah, sometimes. My daughter says to me, this is not nearly as universal, but I would say, to her, you ought to eat your tomatoes. I pick tomatoes because I don't like them. You ought to eat your tomatoes. And she says, what my daughter has learned, my 13-year-old has learned to teach, to turn every ought statement into a statement, I would call it, the yes and no of the palate. Well, they don't taste good. Your taste buds are your taste buds. My taste buds are my taste buds. They're just there. Now, what she's learned to do is to turn, and lots of people, by the way, lots of young people have learned, it's kind of in the culture, to turn moral statements into preferences that aren't quite individualistic, and that can't even, you get a little cross culture, some of them cross cultures, but they also don't cross even their families. Mm-hmm. They're what I call the yes and no of the palate. If it tastes good, do it. Or if it doesn't taste good, don't do it. Parts of ego, ethical egoism, to the extremes, are kind of like that.
They're wearing hats in buildings.
Or bushels of things.
Yeah, I know, but there's things that we've grown up with that are so hard to watch dissipate or not be important. Or
yeah. I don't know. Wearing hats in buildings is one of them for me, but maybe.
Well, it is for teachers, let me tell you.
Yeah, they're wearing hats in classrooms, mm-hmm. Yeah. Classrooms are very interesting. Teachers are going
to church. I watched communion last Sunday. There were only two, I looked around, only two teenagers had hats on during church Sunday, Eucharist. And one of them took it off before he took the communion. The other one went to take it off before communion and then decided to put it back on again. He was in line to take communion. And he was thinking it through.
Well, what's happened is if you turn killing into yes and no of the palate,
if it's not good to me, or if it is good to me.
Well, so one of the things I'm trying to do is give, how would you, you know, what kind of moral principles or foundations or institutions would you capitalize on in order to fight that? Now, what happens to these children is, my children weren't born with these things. They're getting enculturated. My children are learning it every day. You know, put yourself in the other person's shoes, you know. Elena, put yourself in Krista's shoes. If you were bigger, blah, 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 would you like to see? And so you teach them, you try to teach them, and you have them practice moral perspective taking, social perspective taking, this consent, this mutual reciprocal consent type of thing. But if you grow up in a household, or and in your other kind of life world situations, nobody's doing that with you. And you're also being violated tremendously on the other side. Those two combination of those two things, you get past what we would call sociopaths. You better just lock them up. Because for the protection of society at large, you better lock them up.
Is that a not?
Yes, I would argue for that. Because of the vulnerability of human creatures, and the most vulnerable in society, lots of these, of course, are people become experts in their own way. And at spotting vulnerable people, and the most vulnerable people. And they become experts by doing it just by the way other people carry themselves. So for instance, I was doing this with my daughter just when we were out hiking yesterday. She goes, she doesn't like bees. And so a bee comes, and she looks, she goes, like this. And even in that really extreme, I mean, she really does. She kind of screams, and it's a signal of I'm vulnerable. Now, that bee doesn't understand that. But if generally in life, for general, when fearful situations come, and she just even starts going with that, people, you spot that, you know, just, you don't have to be an expert to do that. And so it's not unusual for people who are vulnerable to be preyed upon, because they give off vulnerable signals. And we know all those, you know.
Is it legitimate? We're talking about more deliberation and argumentation, and I hear what you're saying about it is that you go into that argumentation, you like blow everybody out of the water, and no one wants to talk about it for 3 years. At least that's my experience. But in order to, I'm interested in how to make those happen. And you know, we all seem like, it seems to me that most people are agreed that we want to be healthy. And people that want to enter into the argument will say and agree that we all want to be healthy. So how can we do that? And then they talk about psychological health and spiritual health. And then that makes it a nice balance between the spiritual and the other. And then you can go into that deliberation with a basis for agreement. And I'm still scared because I've been in so many of these, and you need almost an expert facilitator. How do you start? How do you get started?
Well, do this. I think that that I've been grappling with that. I think what you're talking about, I've been adding something, you know, this bottom one, the trust principle, is the one that I've been thinking about more and more for congregations, you know. For instance, because lots of congregations, well, they don't trust each other, or they don't trust getting into more, or so they just don't do it. So this tends to ask, these principles tend to ask questions, or try to answer questions. The discourse principle, or the participatory principle, asks the question, who should be involved? And the consent principle, the next one, maybe that's, the next one says, how should you get involved? How should the, what's the procedure? The how of the procedure. The first one is the who of the procedure. The next one is the how of the procedure. The next one is the why of the procedure. And the last one is the, it's kind of another kind of why. The argumentation principle is more of a cognitive why principle. The last one, the trust principle, is more like a motivational why. Or, I haven't exactly, I'm just kind of thinking that out loud, but it does have to do more with it's the affect part of it, by the way, too. That's actually what I'm going to talk about a little bit.
It seems to me, though, that the only reason I can get people to come and discourse is they're saying, you ask the question, are we okay? And if nothing seems to be the matter, then people go, yeah, we're fine, we won't talk more. But if you ask the question, are we okay, and we're not okay, then everybody wants to talk. And they want to do something. So in a sense, it seems like you've got to have a catastrophe or crisis before people will address anything. And it's so reactive, and is there some proactive way?
Okay, let's try that.
Yeah.
Actually, today we'll do in 15 minutes. I'm not sure if I can do this in 15 minutes. So at least not the way I'm used to doing it. So let's have to do it. The Good Samaritan for a Good Society. We all know the Good Samaritan story. Most of us. It occurs in which book of the Bible? Just for our remembrance, we'll check ourselves out.
It's only in one.
It's in the Gospel of Luke, the 10th chapter. Don't look it up. We know this story so well. We can tell the story to ourselves, and we can probably even tell it verbatim. We'll have key parts in here verbatim. How does the Good Samaritan story start? Now, what you have to know is the Good Samaritan story. Yeah, how does it start?
Robbers hurt.
Dude on the road that.
There was a man on the road. There was a man.
Taking a trip.
Now, on the road.
To where? Samaria. I don't know.
No,
Damascus. Jerusalem. One of those places.
He's on that horrible road in the valley.
No.
I know where the
But road. It is a story within a story. That's one of the things.
And fill among thieves.
It's a story within a story. And when it starts off, the story itself starts off, there was a man. Where's the man? Going down from, where do you go down from?
Jerusalem,
because Jerusalem's on the hill.
To Jericho.
To Jericho. Going down from Jerusalem to Jericho.
You're right.
And what happened?
He fell among thieves.
We even know the words. He fell among thieves and
they stripped him.
Beat him.
And left him by the wayside to die.
And left him. See now, with new translations, so I should do this up for me. So, but I think still, even the new RSV says, and left him for half dead. And left him half dead. Stripped him, beat him, and left him. Stripped him, beat him, and left him half dead. Robbed him. Left him half dead. Okay, well, that's how the story goes. We'll keep going on it. But it's actually already a story within a story. Because who tells the story?
Jesus.
Why does Jesus tell the story?
Love your neighbor as yourself.
Yes, that's what comes up just before that. Who says that in this particular story?
Who should? There was a question given to Jesus.
Yeah.
There was a guy named, I better help us.
Usually I coax us along, but it'll take us longer. There was a lawyer.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Any lawyers in the group? Lawyers of those days were not lawyers.
They were scribes. Right?
They were theologians. The lawyer was somebody who was an expert in the law, which means an expert in the Old Testament. So, you know any Old Testament teachers? Have any favorite Old Testament teachers? So there was a lawyer, there was an Old Testament teacher who came up to Jesus and said,
"Who is my neighbor?"
Not yet. Said, "What must I do?" A nice Jewish question to inherit eternal life.
Yeah,
a very good. Jesus said,
"There are two commandments."
Not quite. In this version, he does it a little differently from traditionally. Jesus said, "Well, what does the law say? You're a lawyer. What does the law say? You're a theologian of the Old Testament. What does the Old Testament say?" And the man, and the lawyer, answers and says, he takes two Bible passages from the Old Testament and glues them together. He says, "Thou shalt love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, all your strength, and your neighbor as yourself." He took one from Deuteronomy and one from Leviticus, and he stuck them together. And so then Jesus says,
"You're right.
You have answered rightly." And then Luke says, and the lawyer, Luke was a Lutheran, because...
Lutheran doctor, boy.
Right. Because then Luke, the narrator says, and the lawyer, seeking to justify himself, seeking to justify himself, asked Jesus, and
who is my neighbor?
And then Jesus goes on, "Who is my neighbor?" There was a man who was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell amongst thieves. And they stripped him and robbed him and left him for half dead. Now what happens?
Some people walk by.
Yes, but one at a time. Now we're going on the pass.
Who walks by first?
Right. And a priest comes by.
Yeah.
And a priest sees the man. And what happens?
Crosses over and passes
by. On the Other Side. And so there's a journal out here, right out there. It's called On the Other Side. And that journal is named after the story. On the Other Side. Passes by on the other side. And he was also going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. We have to talk a little bit about that. Black people are going from Jerusalem to Jericho. Because Jericho was the red light district, kind of. It was the Las Vegas of the day. So when I'm going on vacation, you did it on the sly. Another guy comes by, another person, a Levite comes by, who's kind of the altar guild. So you get the theologian, the priest, and the altar guild comes by. And the Levite sees the man and walks by on the other side, passes by on the other side. A Samaritan comes on the road. Doesn't say going down. A Samaritan passes by. And what happens? Pity. That's it. The most pitiful. We're going to come back to that. Pitiful translation of that word. It takes pity. It's a pitiful translation. Has pity on me. Now, I'm going to go back. What I didn't do in the beginning is I have a riddle when I start off this. And the riddle is, how is the Good Samaritan like Humpty Dumpty? And so nobody will know that one yet. And so then I try to give you another one more hint in my riddle. Is how is the Good Samaritan like Humpty Dumpty and not like Humpty Dumpty? And like Judas Iscariot and not like Judas Iscariot? How is the Good Samaritan like Humpty Dumpty and like Judas Iscariot? And not like him? Well, it does have to do with this word pity.
Iscariot. Jesus couldn't put the pieces back together.
Well, there is a part to that.
Humpty Dumpty could.
No, he couldn't.
Humpty Dumpty fell. Santa Law, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses, all like.
But why is the Good Samaritan?
Why is the Good Samaritan? That's the question, of course. How is he like this? Well, the Good Samaritan has pity on the man and bandages his wounds and puts him on his own donkey and takes him down to the inn and says to the innkeeper, take care of him, and pays him a bunch of money and says, whatever else you take care of, I'll pay you on my way back. End of the story. Yeah, who is my neighbor? And then at the end of the story, that's the end of the story. I'll pay you back when I get back. Then Jesus says,
lay down your life.
Which one was his neighbor?
Who do you think when you start off when Jesus says, or the man says that, who is my neighbor? And Jesus starts telling the story. So who do you think, as Jesus is telling the story, is the neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Who do you think is the neighbor is the story? Think of yourself listening to the story, and who is the neighbor?
Anybody who falls off the wall.
So the man who falls amongst thieves, there was a man who fell amongst thieves, is your neighbor. Mm-hmm. At the end, Jesus says, who proved neighbor? Who proved neighbor?
Samaritan.
Who proved to be the neighbor?
Samaritan.
The Samaritan proved to be the neighbor. Interestingly, when you're listening to the story, you think the neighbor is this guy. And what you find out is that the Samaritan is the neighbor. And Jesus says, who proved neighbor? Who proved to be neighbor? And the guy says, the lawyer says, well, the Samaritan proved to be neighbor. And Jesus says,
go and do likewise.
Go and do likewise. So there's a twist on who the neighbor is. There's a twist in the story. Why is the story called the Good Samaritan? Does it say any place in the story that he's good? If we read it, you'd find out that. Does it say any place in the story that he's good?
No, but Samaritans had a bad reputation.
Right, we can do all that. Yeah. The Jews and the Samaritans didn't like each other. The Samaritans were half-breeds and were
polytheists. Well, they were unclean. Why would someone unclean touch somebody that's clean?
Why is he called the Good Samaritan? Actually, he is. There's no place in the story that says Good Samaritan. You know, we named hospitals Good Samaritan Hospital in Portland, Oregon.
Well, he did good things for the Christian.
He did good things. See, that's why even the word pity is such a pitiful translation. That is exactly what the translation says in the RSV, I think. Not the RSV, but the King James Version, which a lot of us learned it, said pity. He didn't do good things. Well, if you look up, back to the riddle about the Good Samaritan and Humpty Dumpty, and now.
Now we can look in the Bible?
Now you can look in the Bible and look at Acts 1, verse 15, and you'll find out a story about Judas Iscariot. How did Judas die?
Hung himself?
Hung himself. What else?
He was disemboweled.
Yeah, there are two versions of death of Judas. And one version in the Luke Acts, Luke who probably wrote Acts, in Acts 1 verse 15, so this is after Jesus ascends into heaven and the disciples are all together and they have to get, they're talking about, you know, what happens. Judas isn't one of them anymore. They have to get a new guy, you know, in substitute, second career disciple. In those days, Peter stood up among the brethren, the company of persons was in all about 120, and said, "Brothers and sisters, the scripture had to be fulfilled, which the Holy Spirit spoke beforehand by the mouth of David concerning Judas, who was guide to those who arrested Jesus. For he was numbered among us and was allotted his share in this ministry." Verse 18. "Now this man," that is Judas, "bought a field with the reward of his wickedness." Right? He went out and bought a field. And a field with the reward of his wickedness, and falling headlong, he burst open in the middle, and all his bowels gushed out. Sounds a little like Humpty Dumpty. He burst open in the middle, and all his bowels fell out. Now that word, in other words, he jumped off the cliff, and he splattered all over him, jumping down off the cliff. Imagine. In Greek, that's all one word. He burst open in the middle, and all his bowels gushed out. One word in Greek. It's a great word. Long word. Splagnizomai. Now you all have to say that. Splagnizomai. 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 It's all one long Greek word, splagnizomai. Judas jumps off the cliff and splagnizomai.
Did he jump or fell?
Well, fell, jump. Probably. You know, because the other version says that he hung himself, so it's probably not kind of a half-hang, jump, fall, maybe it broke. Yeah, maybe there's just two different stories of how he died. Probably it's more of the case, and they kept both of them in the Bible. Splagdizomai. Anyway, he burst open in the middle, and all his bowels gushed out. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Humpty Dumpty had to re-fall, looking for his bowels, and then couldn't put Humpty together again, because all burst open in the middle, and all his bowels gushed out. Now, the Good Samaritan is not a Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan is a splagnizomai Samaritan. Because when he sees the man who had fallen amongst thieves, he splagnizomais. What happens is his insides go out for this man. And we use that expression, "My heart goes out for you, my guts go out for you. I'm turned inside out." Which is why pity is such a pitiful. Now the RSV and the new RSV use a better word, a better heart, compassion.
So are you saying that that word is used in the Good Samaritan story?
Yes, splagnizomai. That's exactly the word.
Same word.
Same word, exactly the same word. Splagnizomai. And so when it says in Luke 10 verse 36 or so, he splagnizomai. That's exactly the word.
No, it's 33. But the Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion.
He splagnizomai. Very same word as.
I wonder if I should.
His bowels gushed out. He burst in the middle, and all his bowels gushed out. Very same word. Because as many. Even in our language, you know, "my heart goes out for you." You might write a letter of consolation, you know, "my heart goes out for you, my soul goes out for you." What the Samaritan is, well, there's one other person in the Gospel of Luke, one or two, who also splagnizomai besides the Good Samaritan.
Did Jesus do it when Lazarus died?
Jesus does it, but not when Lazarus dies, because that's in the Gospel of Luke. Jesus does do it several times. Jesus and God are the ones who have splagnizomai in the Gospel of Luke. And Jesus does it, for instance, he comes in, he's walking up to the city, and he sees a funeral procession. Mm. And there's a widow whose only son has died. He's walking up to the city of Nain, it's called the widow of Nain's story. And he sees the, interestingly enough, and he sees the woman, and he has compassion on her, because now she is totally without a male. Not only doesn't have a husband, but doesn't have a son. And if you're without a male in those societies, you are the most vulnerable.
fall on people. And so he has compassion on her and raises the son. It's plugged into one of the scenes that Jesus bursts open in the middle and all his guts go. It's a great image of it, but pity really means it. Compassion is better. What I think is going on in this story is one of the things I think of is that human beings are created essentially with a tension built into us. And the tension is between this outgoingness of us. And usually the Bible calls that, as a nice word, spirit. Because the spirit is the outgoingness. So the Holy Spirit is the outgoingness of God that goes out from God into the world. It's kind of the compassion of God, or the spilling out of God, and that brings us all back together. Spirit is like what happens. My girls love to watch the Olympics, the Winter Olympics in particular. What we most like to watch is what?
Ice skating.
The ice skating. We watch some other ones too. But, you know, our dog can watch that all day long and nothing happens. But when you're watching the figure skating and you're waiting, yeah, they're going to make that triple lux right in the beginning. You know because they do that before they get tired. They make the big moves early. And they kind of circle around. And you can kind of see everybody. If you've ever been in a big room that's all watching the Olympics.